From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Beyond the Threshold by August Erleth. The story is really my grandfather's, in a manner of speaking. However, it belongs to the entire family, and beyond them to the world. And there is no longer any reason for suppressing the singularly terrible details of what happened in that lonely house deep in the forest places of northern Wisconsin. The roots of the story go back into the mist of early time, far beyond the beginnings of the Alwyn family line. But of this I knew nothing at the time of my visit to Wisconsin, in response to my cousin's letter about our grandfather's strange decline in health. Josiah Alwyn had always seemed somehow immortal to me, even as a child, and he had not appeared to change throughout the years, between a barrel-chested old man with a heavy full face, decorated with a closely clipped mustache and a small beard to soften the hard line of his square jaw. His eyes were dark, not over large, and his brows were shaggy. He wore his hair long, so that his head appeared to be like a lion. Though I saw little of him when I was still very young, he left an indelible impression on me in the brief visits he paid when he stopped at the ancestral country home near Arkham in Massachusetts. Those short calls he made on his way to and from remote corners of the world, Tibet, Mongolia, the Arctic regions, and certain little-known islands in the Pacific. I had not seen him for years when the letter came from my cousin Frolin, who lived with him in the old house grandfather owned in the heart of the forest and lake country of northern Wisconsin. I wish you could uproot yourself from Massachusetts long enough to come out here. A great deal of water has passed under various bridges, and the wind has blown about many changes since last you were here. Frankly, I think it's most urgent that you come. In present circumstances, I don't know to whom to turn, grandfather being not himself, and I need someone who can be trusted. There was nothing obviously urgent about the letter, and yet there was a queer constraint. There was something between the lines that stood out invisibly, intangibly, to make possible only one answer to Frolin's letter. Something in his phrase about the wind. Something in the way he had written, grandfather being not himself. Something in the need he had expressed for someone who can be trusted. I could easily take leave of absence from my position as assistant librarian at Miskatonic University in Arkham and go west that September. So I went. I went, harassed by an almost uncanny conviction that the need for haste was great, from Boston by plane to Chicago, and from there by train to the village of Harmon, deep in the forest country of Wisconsin, a place of great natural beauty, not far from the shores of Lake Superior, so that it was possible in days of wind and weather to hear the water sound. Frolin met me at the station. My cousin was in his late 30s then, but he had the look of someone 10 years younger, with hot, intense brown eyes and a soft, sensitive mouth that belied his inner hardness. He was singularly sober, though he had always alternated between gravity and a kind of infectious wildness, the Irish in him, as grandfather had once said. I met his eyes when I shook his hand, probing for some clue to his withheld distress. But I saw only that he was indeed troubled, for his eyes betrayed him, even as the roiled waters of a pond reveal disturbance below, though the surface may be as glass. "What is it?" I asked when I sat at his side in the coop, riding into the country of the tall pines. "Is the old man abed?" He shook his head. Oh, no, nothing like that, Tony. He shot me a queer, restrained glance. You'll see. You wait and see. What is it, then? I pressed him. Your letter had the damnedest sound. I hoped it would, he said gravely. And yet there was nothing I could put my finger on, I admitted. But it was there, nevertheless. He smiled. Yes, I knew you'd understand. I tell you, it's been difficult, extremely difficult. I thought of you a good many times before I sat down and wrote that letter, believe me. But if he's not ill? I thought you said he wasn't himself. Yes, yes, so I did. You wait now, Tony. Don't be so impatient. You'll see for yourself. It's his mind, I think. His mind? I felt a distinct wave of regret and shock at the suggestion that grandfather's mind had given way. The thought that that magnificent brain had retreated from sanity was intolerable, and I was loath to entertain it. Surely not, I cried. Frohlin, what the devil is it? He turned his troubled eyes on me once more. I don't know, but I think it's something terrible. If it were only grandfather. But there's the music, and then there are all the other things, the sounds and smells and... He caught my amazed stare and turned away, almost with physical effort, pausing in his talk. But I'm forgetting. Don't ask me anything more. Just wait. You'll see for yourself. He laughed shortly, a forced laugh. Perhaps it's not the old man who's losing his mind. I've thought of that sometimes, too, with reason. I said nothing more, but there was beginning to mushroom up inside me now a kind of tense fear. For some time I sat by his side, thinking only of Frohlin and old Josiah Alwyn, living together in that old house, unaware of the towering pines all around, and the wind sound, and the fragrant pungence of leaf fire smoke riding the wind out of the northwest. Evening came early to this country, caught in the dark pines, and though afterglow still lingered in the west, fanning upward in a great wave of saffron and amethyst, darkness already possessed the forest through which we rode. Out of the darkness came the cries of the great horned owls and their lesser cousins, the screech owls, making an eerie magic in the stillness broken otherwise only by the wind's voice and the noise of the car passing along the comparatively little used road to the Alwyn house. We're almost there, said Frohlin. The lights of the car passed over a jagged pine. Lightning struck years ago, and standing still with two gaunt limbs arched like gnarled arms towards the road, an old landmark to which Frohlin's words called my attention, since he knew I would remember it but half a mile from the house. If grandfather should ask, he said then, I'd rather you said nothing about my sending for you. I don't know that he'd like it. You can tell him you were in the Midwest and came up for a visit. I was curious anew, but forbore to press Frohlin further. He does know I'm coming, then? Yes. I said I had word from you and was going down to meet your train. I could understand that if the old man thought Frohlin had sent for me about his health, he would be annoyed and perhaps angry. And yet more than this was implied in Frohlin's request, more than just a simple salving of grandfather's pride. Once more that odd, intangible alarm rose up within me, that sudden, inexplicable feeling of fear. The house looked forth suddenly in a clearing among the pines. It had been built by an uncle of grandfather's in Wisconsin's pioneering days, back in the 1850s, by one of the seafaring Alwyns of Innsmouth, that strange, dark town on the Massachusetts coast. It was an unusually unattractive structure, snug against the hillside like a crusty old woman in furbelows. It defied many architectural standards without, however, seeming ever fully free of most of the superficial facets of architecture circa 1850, making for the most grotesque and pompous appearance of structures of that day. It suffered a wide veranda, one side of which led directly into the stables where, in former days, horses, surreys, and buggies had been kept, and where now two cars were housed. The only corner of the building which gave any evidence at all of having been remodeled since it was built. The house rose 2 1/2 stories above a cellar floor. Presumably, for darkness made it impossible to ascertain, it was still painted the same hideous brown, and judging by what light shone forth from the curtain windows, Grandfather had not yet taken the trouble to install electricity, a contingency for which I had come well prepared by carrying a flashlight and an electric candle, with extra batteries for both. Frohlin drove into the garage, left the car, and carrying some of my baggage, led the way down the veranda to the front door, a massive, thick-paneled oak piece, decorated with a ridiculously large iron knocker. The hall was dark, save for a partly open door at the far end, out of which came a faint light, which was yet enough to illuminate, spectrally, the broad stairs leading to the upper floor. "I'll take you to your room first," said Frohlin, leading the way up the stairs, sure-footed with habitual walking there. "There's a flashlight on the newel post at the landing," he added, "if you need it. You know the old man." I found the light and lit it, making only enough delay so that when I caught up with Frohlin, he was standing at the foot of my room, which I noticed was almost directly over the front entrance and thus faced west, as did the house itself. "He's forbidden us to use any of the rooms east of the hall up here," said Frohlin, fixing me with his eyes, as much as to say, "You see how queer he's got?" He waited for me to say something, but since I did not, he went on. "So I have the room next to yours, and Ho is on the other side of me, in the southwest corner. Right now, as you might have noticed, Ho's getting something to eat."
"And Grandfather?"
"Very likely in a study. You'll remember that room." I did indeed remember that curious windowless room, built under explicit directions by great Uncle Leander. A room that occupied the majority of the rear of the house, the entire northwest corner, and all the west width, save for a small corner at the southwest, where the kitchen was, the kitchen from which a light had streamed into the lower hall at our entrance. The study had been pushed partway back into the hill slope, so the east wall could not have windows, but there was no reason save Uncle Leander's eccentricity for the windowless north wall. Squarely in the center of the east wall, indeed built into the wall, was an enormous painting, reaching from the floor to the ceiling, and occupying a width of over 6 feet. If this painting, apparently executed by some unknown friend of Uncle Leander's, if not by my great-uncle himself, had had about any mark of genius or even of unusual talent, this display might have been overlooked. But it did not. It was a perfectly prosaic representation of a north country scene, showing a hillside with a rocky cave opening out into the corner of the picture, a scarcely defined path leading to the cave, an impressionistic beast which was evidently meant to resemble a bear, once common in this country, walking toward it, and overhead something that looked like an unhappy cloud lost among the pines rising darkly all around. This dubious work of art completely and absolutely dominated the study, despite the shelves of books that occupied almost every available niche and what remained of the walls in that room, despite the absurd collection of oddities strewn everywhere. Bits of curiously carven stone and wood, strange mementos of great-uncle's seafaring life. The study had all the lifelessness of a museum, and yet, oddly, it responded to my grandfather like something alive, even the painting on the wall seeming to take on an added freshness whenever he entered. "I don't think anyone who ever stepped into that room could forget it," I said with a grim smile. "He spends most of his time there, hardly goes out at all, and I suppose with winter coming on, he'll come out only for his meals. He's moved his bed, too." I shuddered. "I can't imagine sleeping in that room." "No, nor I. But you know, he's working on something, and I sincerely believe his mind has been affected."
"Another book on his travels, perhaps?"
He shook his head. "No, a translation, I think. Something different. He found some old papers of Leander's one day, and ever since then he seems to have got progressively worse." He raised his eyebrows and shrugged. "Come on, Ho will have supper ready by this time, and you'll see for yourself." Froland's cryptic remarks had led me to expect an emaciated old man. After all, Grandfather was in his early 70s, and even he could not be expected to live forever.
but he had not changed physically at all, as far as I could see. There he sat at his supper table, still the same hearty old man, his mustache and beard not yet white, but only iron gray, and still with plenty of black in them. His face was no less heavy, his color no less ruddy. At the moment of my entrance, he was eating heartily from the drumstick of a turkey. Seeing me, he raised his eyebrows a little, took the drumstick from his lips, and greeted me with no more excitement than if I had been away from him but half an hour. "You're looking well," he said. "And you," I said, "an old war horse?" He grinned. "My boy, I am on the trail of something new, some unexplored country apart from Africa, Asia, and the Arctic regions." I flashed a glance at Frohlin. Clearly, this was news to him. Whatever hints Grandfather might have dropped of his activities, they had not included this. He had asked then about my trip west, and the rest of the supper hour was taken up with small talk of other relatives. I observed that the old man, returned insistently to long-forgotten relatives in Innsmouth. What had become of them? Had I ever seen them? What did they look like? Since I knew practically nothing of the relatives in Innsmouth, and had the firm conviction that all had died in a strange catastrophe which had washed many inhabitants of that shunned city out to sea, I was not helpful. But the tenor of these innocuous questions puzzled me no little. In my capacity as librarian at Miskatonic University, I had heard strange and disturbing hints of the business in Innsmouth. I knew something of the appearance of federal men there, and stories of foreign agents had never had about them that essential ring of truth, which made a plausible explanation for the terrible events that had taken place in that city. He wanted to know at last whether I had ever seen pictures of them, and when I said I had not, he was quite patently disappointed. "Do you know," he said dejectedly, "there does not exist even a likeness of Uncle Leander? But the old-timers around Harmon told me years ago that he was a very homely man, that he reminded them of a frog." Abruptly he seemed more animated. He began to talk a little faster. "Do you have any conception of what that means, my boy? But no, you wouldn't have. It's too much to expect." He sat for a while in silence, drinking his coffee, drumming on the table with his fingers, and staring into space with a curiously preoccupied air, until suddenly he rose and left the room, inviting us to come to the study when we had finished. "What do you make of that?" asked Frohlin when the sound of the study door closing came to us. "Curious," I said. "But I see nothing abnormal there, Frohlin, I'm afraid." He smiled grimly. "Wait. Don't judge yet. You've been here scarcely 2 hours. We went to the study after supper, leaving the dishes to Ho and his wife, who had served my grandfather for 20 years in the house. This study was unchanged, save for the addition of the old double bed, pushed up against the wall, which separated the room from the kitchen. Grandfather was clearly waiting for us, or rather for me, and if I had had occasion to thank Cousin Frohlin cryptic, there is no word adequate to describe my grandfather's subsequent conversation. "Have you heard of the Wendigo?" he asked. I admitted that I had come upon it among other North Country Indian legends. The belief in a monstrous supernatural being, horrible to look upon, the haunter of the great forest silences. He wanted to know whether I had ever thought of there being a possible connection between this legend of the Wendigo and the air elements, and upon my replying in the affirmative, he expressed a curiosity about how I had come to know the Indian legend in the first place, taking pains to explain that the Wendigo had nothing whatever to do with his question. "In my capacity as a librarian, I have occasion to run across a good many out-of-the-way things," I answered. "Ah," he exclaimed, reaching for a book out next to his chair, "then doubtless you may be familiar with this volume." I looked at the heavy black-bound volume, whose title was stamped only on its backbone in gold leaf. "The Outsider and Others" by H.P. Lovecraft. I nodded. "This book is on our shelves. You've read it, then?" "Oh, yes, most interesting." "Then you'll have read what he has to say about Innsmouth in his strange story. the shadow over Inn's mouth. What do you make of that?
I reflected hurriedly, thinking back to the story, and presently it came to me. A fantastic tale of horrible sea beings, spawn of Cthulhu, breast beast of primordial origin living deep in the sea.
The man had a good imagination, I said.
Had? Is he dead then?
Yes, 3 years ago.
Alas, I thought to learn from him.
But surely this fiction I began.
He stopped me.
Since you have offered no explanation of what took place in Inn's mouth, how can you be so sure that his narrative is fiction?
I admitted that I could not, but it seemed that the old man had already lost interest. Now he drew forth a bulky envelope bearing many of the familiar 3-cent 1869 stamps so dear to collectors, and from this took out various papers which he said Uncle Leander had left with instructions for their consignment to the flames. His wish, however, had not been carried out, explained Grandfather, and he had come into possession of them. He handed a few sheets to me and requested my opinion of them, watching me shrewdly all the while. The sheets were obviously from a long letter written in a crabbed hand and with some of the most awkward sentence imaginable. Moreover, many of the sentences did not seem to me to make sense, and the sheet at which I looked longest was filled with allusions strange to me. My eyes caught words like Ithaqua, Loigor, Hashtur. It was not until I handed the sheets back to my grandfather that it occurred to me that I had seen those words elsewhere, not too long ago. But I said nothing. I explained that I could not help feeling that Uncle Leander wrote with needless obfuscation. Grandfather chuckled.
I should have thought that the first thing which would have occurred to you would have been similar to my own reaction. But no, you failed me. Surely it's obvious that the whole business is a code.
Of course. That would explain the awkwardness of his lines. My grandfather smirked.
A fairly simple code, but adequate, entirely adequate.
I have not yet finished with it.
He tapped the envelope with one index finger. It seems to concern this house, and there is in it a repeated warning that one must be careful and not pass beyond the threshold for fear of dire consequences. My boy, I have crossed and recrossed every threshold in this house scores of times, and there have been no consequences. So therefore, somewhere there must exist a threshold I have not yet crossed. I could not help smiling at his animation. If Uncle Leander's mind was wandering, you've been off on a pretty chase, I said. Abruptly, Grandfather's well-known impatience boiled to the surface. With one hand he swept my uncle's papers away, with the other he dismissed us both, and it was plain to see that Frohlin and I had on the instant ceased to exist for him. We rose, made our excuses, and left the room. In the half-dark of the hall beyond, Frohlin looked at me, saying nothing, only permitting his hot eyes to dwell upon mine for a long minute before he turned and led the way upstairs, where we parted, each to go to his own room for the night. The nocturnal activity of the subconscious mind has always been of deep interest to me, since it has seemed to me that unlimited opportunities are opened up before every alert individual. I have repeatedly gone to bed with some problem vexing me, only to find it solved in so far as I am capable of solving it upon waking. Of those other, more devious activities of the night mind, I have less knowledge. I know that I retired that night with the question of where I had encountered my Uncle Leander's strange words before strong and foremost in my mind. And I know that I went to sleep at last with that question unanswered. Yet when I awoke in the darkness some hours later, I knew at once that I have seen those words, those strange proper names in the book by H.P. Lovecraft, which I had read at Miskatonic, and it was only secondarily that I was aware of someone tapping at my door and called out in a hushed voice, "It's Frohlin! Are you awake? I'm coming in." I got up, slipped on my dressing gown, and lit my electric candle. By this time, Frohlin was in the room, his thin body trembling a little, possibly from the cold, for the September night air flowing through my window was no longer of summer. "What's the matter?" I asked. He came over to me, a strange light in his eyes, and put a hand on my arm. "Can't you hear it?" he asked. "God, perhaps it is my mind." "No, wait," I exclaimed. From somewhere outside, it seemed, came the sound of weirdly beautiful music. Flutes, I thought. "Grandfather's at the radio," I said. "Does he often listen so late?" The expression on his face halted my words. "I own the only radio in the house. It's in my room, and it's not playing. The battery's run down, in any case. Besides, did you ever hear such music on the radio?" I listened with renewed interest. The music seemed strangely muffled, and yet it came through. I observed also that it had no definite direction. While before it had seemed to come from outside, it now seemed to come from underneath the house, a curious chant-like playing of reeds and pipes. "A flute orchestra," I said. "Or panpipes," said Frohlin. "They don't play them anymore," I said absently. "Not on the radio," answered Frohlin. I looked up at him sharply. He returned my gaze steadily. It occurred to me that his unnatural gravity had a reason for being, whether or not he wished to put the reason into words. I caught hold of his arms. "Frohlin, what is it? I can tell you're alarmed." He swallowed hard. "Tony, that music doesn't come from anything in the house. It's from outside." "But who would be outside?" I demanded. "Nothing. No one human." It had come at last. Almost with relief, I faced this issue I had been afraid to admit to myself must be faced. "Nothing, no one human?" "Then what agency?" I asked. "I think Grandfather knows," he said. "Come with me, Tony. Leave the light. We can make our way in the dark." Out in the hall, I was stopped once more by his hand, tense on my arm. "Do you notice?" he whispered sibilantly. "Do you notice this too?" "The smell," I said. "The vague, elusive smell of water, of fish and frogs, and the inhabitants of watery places." "And now," he said. Quite suddenly the smell of water was gone, and instead came a swift frostiness flowing through the hall, as of something alive, the indefinable fragrance of snow, the crisp moistness of snowy air. "Do you wonder I've been concerned?" asked Frohlin. Giving me no time to reply, he led the way downstairs to the door of Grandfather's study, beneath which there shone yet a fine line of yellow light. I was conscious in every step of our descent to the floor below that the music was growing louder, if no more understandable, and now, before the study door, it was apparent that the music emanated from within, and that the strange variety of odors came, too, from that study. The darkness seemed alive with menace, charged with an impending, ominous terror, which enclosed us in a shell, so that Frohlin trembled at my side. Pulsively, I raised my arm and knocked on the door. There was no answer from within, but on the instant of my knock, the music stopped, the strange odors vanished from the air. "You shouldn't have done that," whispered Frohlin. "If he..." I tried the door, yielded to my pressure, and I opened it. I do not know what I expected to see there in the study, but certainly not what I did see. No single aspect of the room had changed, save that Grandfather had gone to bed, and now sat there with his eyes closed and a little smile on his lips, some of his work open before him on the bed, and the lamp burning. I stood for an instant staring, not daring to believe my eyes. Incredible before the prosaic scene I looked upon. Whence then had come the music I had heard, and the odors and fragrances in the air? Confusion took possession of my thoughts, and I was about to withdraw, disturbed by the repose of my grandfather's features, when he spoke. "Come in, then," he said, without opening his eyes. "So you heard the music, too?" I had begun to wonder why no one else heard it. "Mongolian, I think." 3 nights ago, it was clearly Indian, North Country, again, Canada and Alaska. I believe there are places where Ithaqua is still worshipped. Yes, yes. and a week ago, notes I last heard played in Tibet, in forbidden Lhasa, years ago, decades ago. "Who made it?" I cried. "Where did it come from?" He opened his eyes and regarded us standing there. "It came from here, I think," he said, placing the flat of one hand on the manuscript before him. "The sheets written by my great-uncle. And Leander's friends made it. Music of the spheres, my boy. Do you credit your senses?" "I heard it. So did Frolin." "And what can Ho be thinking?" mused Grandfather. He sighed. "I have nearly got it, I think. It only remains to determine which of them Leander communicated." "Which?" I repeated. "What do you mean?" He closed his eyes and the smile came briefly back to his lips. "I thought at first it was Cthulhu. Leander was, after all, a seafaring man. But now, I wonder if it might not be one of the creatures of the air. Lorigor, perhaps, or Ithaqua, whom I believe certain of the Indians called the Wendigo. There is a legend that Ithaqua carries his victims with him in the far spaces above the earth. But I am forgetting myself again. My mind wanders." His eyes flashed open, and I found him regarding us with a peculiarly aloof stare. "It's late," he said. "I need sleep." "What in God's name was he talking about?" asked Frolin in the hall. "Come along," I said. But back in my room once more, with Frolin waiting expectantly to hear what I had to say, I did not know how to begin. How would I tell him about the weird knowledge hidden in the forbidden text at Miskatonic University, the dread Book of Ibon, the obscure Gnotic manuscripts, the terrible relay text, and most shunned of all the Necromonicon of the mad Arab Abdul Azared? How could I say to him with any conviction at all the things that crowded into my mind as a result of hearing my grandfather's strange words, the memories that boiled up from deep within, of powerful ancient ones, elder beings of unbelievable evil, old gods who once inhabited the earth and all the universe as we know it now, and perhaps far more, old gods of ancient good and forces of ancient evil, of whom the latter were now in leash, and yet ever breaking forth, becoming manifest briefly, horribly, to the world of men. And their terrible names came back now. If before this hour my clue to remembrance had not been made strong enough, had been refused in the fastness of my inherent prejudices, Cthulhu, potent leader of the forces of the waters of earth, Yog-Sothoth, and Sat-Hagwa, dwellers in the depths of earth, Yoigor, Hastor, Nathakwa, the Snow Thing, and Windwalker, who are the elementals of air. It was of these beings that Grandfather had spoken, and the inference he had made was too plain to be disregarded, or even to be subject to any other interpretations, that my great-uncle Leander, whose home, after all, had once been in the shunned and now deserted city of Innsmouth, had had traffic with at least one of these beings. There was a further inference that he had not made, but only hinted at in something he had said earlier in the evening, that there was somewhere in the house a threshold beyond which a man dared not walk, and what danger could lurk beyond that threshold put the path back into time, the way back to that hideous communication with the elder beings my uncle Leander had had. And yet, somehow, the full import of my grandfather's words had not dawned upon me. Though he had said so much, there was far more he had left unsaid, and I could not blame myself later for not fully realizing that grandfather's activities were clearly bent towards discovering that hidden threshold of which Uncle Leander had so cryptically written, and crossing it. In the confusion of thought to which I had now come in my preoccupation with the ancient mythology of Cthulhu, Ithaqua, and the Elder Gods, I did not follow the obvious indications to that logical conclusion, possibly because I feared instinctively to go so far. I turned to Frolin and explained him as clearly as I could. He listened attentively, asking a few pointed questions from time to time, and though he paled slightly at certain details, I could not refrain from mentioning. He did not seem to be as incredulous as I might have thought. This in itself was evidence of the fact that there was still more to be discovered about my grandfather's activities and the occurrences in the house, though I did not immediately realize this. However, I was shortly to discover more of the underlying reason for Froland's ready acceptance of my necessarily sketchy outline. In the middle of a question, he ceased talking abruptly, and there came into his eyes an expression indicating that his attention had passed from me, from the room, to somewhere beyond. He sat in an attitude of listening, and impelled by his own actions, I, too, strained to hear what he heard. Only the wind's voice in the trees, rising now a little, I thought. A storm coming? "Do you hear it?" he said in a shaky whisper. "No," I said quietly. "Only the wind." "Yes, yes, the wind. I wrote you, remember. Listen." "Now, come, Froland, take hold of yourself. It's only the wind." He gave me a pitying glance and, going to the window, beckoned me after him. I followed, coming to his side. Without a word, he pointed into the darkness pressing close to the house. It took me a moment to accustom myself to the night, but presently I was able to see the line of trees struck sharply against the star-swept heavens. And then instantly I understood. Though the sound of the wind roared and thundered about the house, nothing whatever disturbed the trees before my eyes. Not a leaf, not a treetop, not a twig swayed by so much as a hair's breadth. "Good God," I exclaimed, and fell back away from the pane, as if to shut the sight from my eyes. "Now you see," he said, stepping back from the window also. "I have heard all this before." He stood quietly as if waiting, and I too waited. The sound of the wind continued unabated. It had by this time reached a frightful intensity, so that it seemed as if the old house must be torn from the hillside and hurtled into the valley below. Indeed, a faint trembling made itself manifest, even as I thought this, a strange tremor as if the house were shuddering. And the pictures on the walls made a slight, almost stealthy movement, almost imperceptible, and yet quite unmistakably visible. I glanced at Froland, but his features were not disquieted. He continued to stand, listening and waiting, so that it was pit that the end of the singular manifestation was not yet. The sounds of the wind was now a terrible demonic howling, and it was accompanied by notes of music, which must have been audible for some time, but were so perfectly blended with the wind's voice that I was not at first aware of them. The music was similar to that which had gone before, as of pipes and occasionally stringed instruments, but was now much wilder, sounding with a terrifying abandon, with a character of unmentionable evil about it. At the same time, two further manifestations occurred. The first was the sound as of someone walking, some great being whose footsteps seemed to flow into the room from the heart of the wind itself. Certainly they did not originate in the house, though there was about them the unmistakable swelling which betokened their approach to the house. The second was a sudden change in the temperature. The night outside was warm for September in upstate Wisconsin, and the house too had been reasonably comfortable. Now, abruptly coincident with the approaching footsteps, the temperature began to drop rapidly, so in a little while the air in the room was cold, and both Froland and I had to put on more clothing in order to keep comfortable. Still, this did not seem to be the height of the manifestations for which Froland was so obviously waiting. He continued to stand, saying nothing, though his eyes, meeting mine from time to time, were eloquent enough to speak his mind. How long we stood there, listening to those frightening sounds from outside, before the end came, I do not know. But suddenly Froland caught my arm and in a hoarse whisper cried, "There! There they are! Listen!" The tempo of the weird music had changed abruptly to a diminuendo from its previous wild crescendo. There came into it now a strain of almost unbearable sweetness, with a little of melancholy to it. music as lovely as previously had been evil, and yet the note of terror was not completely absent. At the same time, there was apparent the sound of voices, raised in a kind of swelling chant, rising from the back of the house somewhere, as if from the study. "Great God in heaven," I cried, sizing Frohlin. "What is it now?" "It's grandfather's doing," he said. "Whether he knows it or not, that thing comes and sings to him." He shook his head and closed his eyes tightly for an instant before saying bitterly in a low, intense voice, "If only that accursed paper of Leander's had been burned as it ought to have been." "You could almost make out the words," I said, listening intently. There were words, but not words I had ever heard before, a kind of horrible primeval mouthing, as if some bestial creature with but half a tongue undulated syllables of meaningless horror. I went over to open the door. Immediately the sound seemed clearer, so that it was evident that what I had mistaken for many voices was but one, which could nevertheless convey the illusion of many. Words? Or perhaps I had better write sounds, bestial sounds. Rose from below a kind of awe-inspiring undulation, calling out Cthulhu, Shub-Niggurath, Ithaqua. Incredibly, the wind's voice rose to howl, ever more terribly, so that I thought at any moment the house would be hurled into the void, and Frohlin and myself torn from its rooms, and the breath sucked from our helpless bodies. In the confusion of fear and wonder that held me, I thought at that instant of grandfather in the study below, and beckoning Frohlin, I ran from the room to the stairs, determined, despite my ghastly fright, to put myself between the old man and whatever menaced him. I ran to his door and flung myself upon it, and once more, as before, all manifestation stopped. As if by the flick of a switch, silence fell like a pall of darkness upon the house. A silence that was momentarily even more terrible. The door gave, and once more I faced grandfather. He was sitting still as we had left him but a short time before, though now his eyes were open. His head was cocked a little to one side, and his gaze was fixed upon the overlarge painting on the east wall. "In God's name," I cried, "what was that?" "I hope to find out before long," he answered with great dignity and gravity. His utter lack of fear quieted my own alarm to some degree, and I came a little further into the room, Frohlin following. I leaned over his bed, striving to fix his attention upon me, but he continued to gaze at the painting with singular intensity. "What are you doing?" I demanded. "Whatever it is, there's danger in it." "An explorer like your grandfather would hardly be content if there were not, my boy," he replied crisply, matter-of-factly. I knew it was true. "I would rather die with my boots on than here in this bed," he went on. "As for what we heard, I don't know now how much of it you heard. That's something for the moment not yet explicable. But I would call to your attention the strange action of the wind." "There was no wind," I said. "I looked." "Yes, yes," he said a little impatiently. "True enough. And yet the wind's sound was there, and all the voices of the wind, just as I have heard it, singing in Mongolia, in the great snowy spaces over the shunned and hidden plateau of Leng, where the Cho people worship strange ancient gods." He turned to face me suddenly, and I thought his eyes feverish. "I did tell you, didn't I, about the worship of Ithaqua, sometimes called Windwalker, and by some, surely the Windigo by certain Indians in Upper Manitoba, and of their beliefs that the Windwalker takes human sacrifices and carries them over the four places of the earth before leaving them behind, dead at last. Oh, there are stories, my boy, odd legends, and something more." He leaned towards me now with a fierce intensity. "I myself seen things. Things found on a body dropped from the air. Just that. Things that could not possibly have been gotten in Manitoba. Things belonging to Leng, to the Pacific Isles." He brushed me away with one arm, and an expression of disgust crossed his face. You don't believe me. You think I'm wandering? Go on, then. Go back to your little sleep, and wait for your last through the eternal misery of monotonous day after day. No, say it now. I'm in no mood to go. I will talk to you in the morning, he said tiredly, leaning back. With that, I had to be content, and he was adamant, and could not be moved, and I bade him good night once more, and retreated into the hall with Frohlin, who stood there shaking his head slowly, forbiddingly. Every time a little worse, he whispered. Every time the wind blows a little louder, the cold comes more intensely, the voices and the music more clearly, and the sound of those terrible footsteps. He turned away and began to retrace the way upstairs, and after a moment of hesitation, I followed. In the morning, my grandfather looked his usual picture of good health. At the moment of my entrance into the dining room, he was speaking to Ho, evidently in answer to a request, for the old servant stood respectfully bowed, while he heard grandfather tell him that he and Mrs. Ho might indeed take a week off, beginning today if it was necessary for Mrs. Ho's health that she go to Wausau to consult a specialist. Frohlin met my eyes with a grim smile. His color had faded a little, leaving him pale and sleepless-looking, but he ate heartily enough. His smile and the brief, indicative glance of his eyes toward Ho's retreating back said clearly that this necessity which had come upon Ho and his wife was their way of fighting the manifestations which had so disturbed my own first night in the house. "Well, my boy," said Grandfather quite cheerfully, "you're not looking nearly as haggard as you did last night. I confess I felt for you. I dare say also you aren't nearly so skeptical as you were." He chuckled, as if this were a subject for joking. I could not, unfortunately, feel the same way about it. I sat down and began to eat a little, glancing at him from time to time, waiting for him to begin his explanation of the strange events of the previous night. Since it became evident shortly that he did not intend to explain, I was impelled to ask for an explanation, and did so with as much dignity as possible. "I'm sorry if you've been disturbed," he said. "The fact of the matter is that the threshold of which Leander wrote must be in that study somewhere, and I felt quite certain I was onto it last night, before you burst into my room the second time. Furthermore, it seems undisputable that at least one member of the family has had traffic with one of those things. Leander, obviously." Frohlin leaned forward. "Do you believe in them?" Grandfather smiled unpleasantly. "It must be obvious that, whatever my abilities, the disturbance you heard last night could hardly have been caused by me." "Yes, of course," agreed Frohlin. "But some other agency?" "No, no, it remains to be determined only which one. The water smells are the sign of the spawn of Cthulhu. But the winds might be Yogyor, or Ithaqua, or Hastur. But the stars aren't right for Hastur," he went on, "so we are left with the other two. There they are, then, or one of them, just across that threshold. I want to know what lies beyond the threshold, if I can find it." It seemed incredible that my grandfather should be talking so unconcernedly about these ancient beings. His prosaic air was in itself almost as alarming as had been the night's occurrences. Temporary feeling of security I had had at the sight of him eating breakfast was washed away. I began to be conscious again of that slowly growing fear I had known on my way to the house last evening, and I regretted having pushed my inquiry. If my grandfather were aware of anything of this, he made no sign. He went on talking much in the manner of a lecturer pursuing a scientific inquiry for the benefit of an audience before him. It was obvious, he said, that a connection existed between the happenings at Innsmouth and Leander Alwyn's non-human contact outside. Did Leander leave Innsmouth originally because of the cult of Cthulhu that existed there? Because he, too, was becoming afflicted with that curious facial change which overtook so many of the inhabitants of accursed Innsmouth. Those strange Bactrian lineaments which horrified the federal investigators who came to examine into the Innsmouth affair. Perhaps this was so. In any event, leaving the Cthulhu cult behind, he had made his way into the wilds of Wisconsin, and somehow he had established contact with another of the elder beings. Yo-Igor, or Ithaqua, all to be noted elemental forces of evil. Leander Alwyn was apparently a wicked man. If there is any truth to this, I cried, then surely Leander's warning ought to be observed. Give up this mad hope of finding the threshold of which he writes. Grandfather gazed at me for a moment with speculative mildness, but it was plain to see that he was actually concerning himself with my outburst. Now I've embarked upon this exploration, I mean to keep to it. After all, Leander died a natural death. But following your own theory, he had traffic with these things, I said. You have none. You're daring to venture out into unknown space? It comes to that, without regard for what horrors might lie there? When I went to Mongolia, I encountered horrors too. I never thought to escape along with my life. He paused reflectively, and then rose slowly. No, I mean to discover Leander's threshold. And tonight, no matter what you hear, try not to interrupt me. It would be a pity if after so long a time, I am still further delayed by your impetuosity. And having discovered the threshold, I cried, what then? I'm not sure I'll want to cross it. The choice may not be yours. He looked at me for a moment in silence, smiled gently, and left the room. Of the events of that catastrophic night, I find it difficult, even at this late date, to write. So vividly do they return to mind, despite the prosaic surroundings of Miskatonic University, where so many of those dread secrets are hidden in ancient and little-known texts. And yet, to understand the widespread occurrence that came after, the events of that night must be known. Frolin and I spent most of the day investigating my grandfather's books and papers in search of verification of certain legends he had hinted at in his conversation, not only with me but with Frolin even before my arrival. Throughout his work occurred many cryptic allusions, but only one narrative at all relative to our inquiry, a somewhat obscure story, clearly of legendary origin, concerning the disappearance of two residents of Nelson, a Manitoba and a constable of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, and their subsequent reappearance, as if dropped from the heavens, frozen and either dead or dying, babbling of Ithaqua, of the Windwalker, and of many places on the faces of the earth, and carrying with them strange objects, mementos of far places, which they had never been known to carry in life. The story was incredible, and yet it was related to the mythology so clearly put down in The Outsider and others, and even more horribly narrated in the Noctic manuscripts, the Rilye texts, and the terrible Necromonicon. Apart from this, we found nothing tangible enough to relate to our problem, and we resigned ourselves to waiting for the night. At luncheon and dinner, prepared by Frolin in the absence of the hose, my grandfather carried on as normally as he was accustomed to, making no reference to a strange exploration, beyond saying that he now had definite proof that Leander had painted that unattractive landscape on the east wall of the study, and that he hoped soon, as he neared the end of deciphering of Leander's long, rambling letter, to find the essential clue to the threshold of which he wrote, and to which he now alluded increasingly. When he rose from the dinner table, he solemnly cautioned us once more not to interrupt him in the night under pain of his extreme displeasure, and so departed into that study out of which he never walked again. "Do you think you can sleep?" Frolin asked me when we were alone. I shook my head. "Impossible. I'll stay up." "I don't think he'd like us to stay downstairs," said Frolin, a faint frown on his forehead. "In my room, then," I replied. "And you?" "With you, if you don't mind. He means to see it through, and there's nothing we can do until he needs us. He may call. I had the uncomfortable conviction that if my grandfather called for us, it would be too late, but I forbore to give voice to my fears. The events of that evening started as before, with the strains of that weirdly beautiful music welling flute-like from the darkness around the house. Then, in a little while, came the wind and the cold and the undulating voice, and then preceded by an aura of evil so great that it was almost stifling in the room. Then came something more, something unspeakably terrible. We had been sitting, Frohlin and I, with a light out. I had not bothered to light my electric candle, since no light we could show would illuminate the source of these manifestations. I faced the window, and when the wind began to rise, looked once again to the line of trees, thinking that surely, certainly they must bend before this great onrushing storm of wind. But again there was nothing, no movement in that stillness, and there was no cloud in the heavens. The stars shone brightly, the constellations of summer moving down to the western rim of earth to make the signature of autumn in the sky. The wind sound had risen steadily, so that now it had the fury of a gale. And yet nothing, no movement disturbed the line of trees dark upon the night sky. But suddenly, so suddenly that for a moment I blinked my eyes in an effort to convince myself that a dream had shuttered my sight, in one large area of the sky the stars were gone. I came to my feet and pressed my face to the pane. It was as if a cloud had abruptly reared up into the heavens to a height almost at the zenith, but no cloud could have come upon the sky so swiftly. On both sides an overhead star still shone. I opened the window and leaned out, trying to follow the dark outline against the stars. It was the outline of some great beast, a horrible caricature of man, rising to a semblance of a head high in the heavens, and there, where its eyes might have been, glowed with a deep carmine fire two stars. Or were they stars? At the same time, the sound of those approaching footsteps grew so loud that the house shook and trembled with their vibrations, and the wind's demonic fury rose to indescribable heights, and the undulation reached such a pitch that it was maddening to hear. "Frohlin," I called hoarsely. I heard him come to my side, and in a moment felt his tight grasp on my arm. So he too had seen it. It was not hallucination, not dream. This giant thing outlined against the stars and moving. "It's moving," whispered Frohlin. "Oh, God, it's coming." He pulled frantically away from the window, and so did I. But in an instant, the shadow on the sky was gone. The stars shone once more. The wind, however, had not decreased in intensity one iota. Indeed, if it were possible, it grew momentarily wilder and more violent. The entire house shuddered and quaked, while those thunderous footsteps echoed and re-echoed in the valley before the house. And the cold grew worse, so that breath hung a white vapor in air, a cold as of outer space. Out of all the turmoil of mind, I thought of the legend in my grandfather's paper, the legend of Ithaqua, whose signature lay in the cold and snow of far northern places. Even as I remembered, everything was driven from my mind by a frightful chorus of adulation, the triumphant chanting as of a thousand bestial mouths. "Ithaqua, Ithaqua," they cried out. Simultaneously came a thunderous crash, and immediately after the voice of my grandfather, raised in a terrible cry, a cry that rose into a scream of mortal terror, so that the names he would have uttered, Frohlin's and mine, were lost, choked back into his throat by the full force of the horror revealed to him. And as abruptly as his voice ceased to sound, all other manifestations came to a stop, leaving again that ghastly, portentous silence to close around us like a cloud of doom. Frohlin reached the door of my room before I did, but I was not far behind. He fell part of the way down the stairs, but recovered in the light of my electric candle, which I had seized on my way out, and together we assaulted the door of the study, calling to the old man inside. But no voice answered, though the line of yellow under the door was evidence that his lamps burned still. The door had been locked from the inside, so that it was necessary to break it down before we could enter. Of my grandfather there was no trace. But in the east wall yawned a great cavity, where the painting, now prone upon the floor, had been. A rocky opening leading into the depths of earth. And over everything in the room lay the mark of Ithaqua. A fine carpet of snow, whose crystals gleamed as from a million tiny jewels in the yellow light of grandfather's lamp. Save for the painting, only the bed was disturbed, as if grandfather had been literally torn out of it by stupendous force. I looked hurriedly to where the old man had kept Uncle Leander's manuscript, but it was gone. Nothing of it remained. Frohlin cried out suddenly and pointed to the painting Uncle Leander had made, and then to the opening yawning before us. "It was here all the time, the threshold," he said. And I saw, even as he, as grandfather, had seen too late, for the painting by Uncle Leander was but the representation of the site of his home before the house had been erected to conceal that cavernous opening into the earth on the hillside, the hidden threshold against which Leander's manuscript had warned, the threshold beyond which my grandfather had vanished. Though there is little more to tell, yet the more damning of all the curious facts remain to be revealed. A thorough search of the cavern was subsequently made by county officials and certain intrepid adventurers from Harmon. It was found to have several openings, and it was plain that anyone or anything wishing to reach the house through the cavern would have had to enter through one of the innumerable hidden crevices discovered among the surrounding hills. The nature of Uncle Leander's activities was revealed after grandfather's disappearance. Frohlin and I were put through a hard grilling by suspicious county officials, but were finally released when the body of my grandfather did not come to light. But since that night, certain facts came into the open, facts which, in the light of my grandfather's hints, coupled with the horrible legends contained in the shunned books locked away here in the library of Miskatonic University, are damning and damnably inescapable. The first of them was the series of gigantic footprints found in the earth at the place where on that fatal night the shadow had risen into the star-swept heavens. The unbelievably wide and deep depressions, as of some prehistoric monster walking there, steps a half mile apart, steps that led beyond the house and vanished at a crevice leading down into that hidden cavern in tracks identical with those found in the snow in northern Manitoba, where those unfortunate travelers and the constable sent to find them had vanished from the face of the earth. The second was the discovery of my grandfather's notebook, together with a portion of Uncle Leander's manuscript encased in ice, found deep in the forest snows of Upper Saskatchewan, and bearing every sign of having been dropped from a great height. The last entry was dated on the day of his disappearance in late September. The notebook was not found until the following April. Neither Frohlin nor I dared to make the explanation of its strange appearance, which came immediately to mind, and together we burned that horrible letter and the imperfect translation grandfather had made. A translation which in itself, as it was written down, with all its warnings against the terror beyond the threshold, had served to summon from outside a creature so horrible that its description has never been attempted by even those ancient writers whose terrible narratives are scattered over the face of the earth. And last of all, the most conclusive, the most damning evidence, the discovery 7 months later of my grandfather's body, on a small Pacific island not far southeast of Singapore, and the curious report made of his condition, perfectly preserved, as if in ice, so cold that no one could touch him with bare hands for 5 days after his discovery, and the singular fact that he was found half buried in sand, as if he had fallen from an aeroplane. Neither Frohlin nor I could any longer have any doubt. This was the legend of Ithaqua, who carried his victims with him into far places of the earth, in time and space, before leaving them behind. And the evidence was undeniable that my grandfather had been alive for part of that incredible journey. For if we had had any doubts, the things found in his pockets, the mementos carried from strange hidden places where he had been and sent to us, were final and damning testimony. The gold plaque, with its miniature presentation of a struggle between ancient beings, and bearing on its surface inscriptions and Kabbalistic designs. The plaque, which Dr. Rackham of Miskatonic University identified as having come from some place beyond the memory of man. The loathsome book in Burmese that revealed ghastly legends of that shunned and hidden plateau of Leng, the place of the dread Chocho people. And finally, the revolting and bestial stone miniature of a hellish monstrosity walking on the winds above the earth.